Welcome to Bits About Books, the home for conversations with authors of breakthrough books on sales, marketing, and business. I am your host, Shubhanjan Sarkar, founder of PitchLink, the next generation buyer-seller engagement platform, where our mission is to make buying easy. Welcome to Bits About Books. Our guest today is Gregory Vetter, and we speak with him about his book, Undressed, the unfiltered story of my failed American dream and how it led to success.
And so I started giving him examples of everything that I had done over the past 15 years. And he said, are these stories true? And I'm like, yeah, they're all true. And he's like, dude, you need to write a book. And I'm like, I'm not really interested in writing a book. I want to be behind the scenes. I don't want to be in the public, really. And he's like, I spend 99% of my time trying to convince my clients to not write books because they're not interesting and they have nothing to say and they can't help anybody with it. I think you need to write a book.
Gregory Vetter is a well-established innovator and disruptor in the clean food movement. The oldest of the Vetter brothers, he had the brilliant idea of launching Tresemme after being inspired by his mother's wildly popular homemade dressing recipe. What Gregory knew, and the American consumer base was soon to discover, was that the idea would soon resonate widely and give rise to an entirely new clean food category. Gregory and his broader family, primarily brothers Matt and Brian, cultivated the business and in a mere 5 years translated their vision into becoming the number one organic salad dressing brand in the refrigerated space. The emergence of Tresemme paved the way for clean manufacturing on a mass scale by virtue of inventing the only gum-free dressing bottling process. Ultimately, that manufacturing process led to the creation of the fresh condiment category and similarly, the first Whole 30 approved bottled dressings and condiments in the nation. With the wind clearly at their back, Gregory and his brothers launched Alta Fresh Food Company. Alta Fresh Food has since pioneered a better way to get great tasting salads to the masses through their innovative master kitting process and breakthrough R&D team. After their triumph as Sam's Club Supplier of the Year, resulting from their master kitting process, Alta was propelled to the forefront of the fresh food solutions industry. More recently, Gregory elected to take his lessons learned from his sustained success in the food industry and launched Homegrown Brand Accelerator. Homegrown was developed with a singular purpose in mind, to empower the next generation of brands by making the playbook available to whomever had the desire to build the next great American brand. Winner of Inc. Magazine's Entrepreneur of the Year Award, Inc. Magazine 35 Under 35, EY Entrepreneur of the Year Finalist, TED Talk Speaker, Nielsen Design Impact Award for Packaging, and Sam's Club Supplier of the Year, Gregory spends his time with his wife and 4 children on their farm in West River. Now, onto this fascinating story, or should I say, the naked truth, directly from Greg Vetter. Greg, welcome to Bits About Books. I'm delighted to have you here, and this will be a very different conversation than what we have been having here for the last many months. So I'm really looking forward to this.
I am also excited to be here.
Before we even get into the conversation, the first thing I would like to know is, what are you doing now and what made you write this book?
So right now, I run a couple different businesses that we've started since the end of my previous journey. And that combined with marketing and talking about this book takes up most of my time. And then you layer in 4 kids, a wife, and a farm, and you basically have my life in a nutshell.
Yeah. That was really succinct. I mean, I can make out you have been doing this for a long time now. You have had many such sessions where you have answered this question, which is good. So what prompted you to write the book, actually? Because as you sort of touched upon in the introduction, that mostly people do not like to write about things failing.
Yep.
But you chose to do that. Mm-hmm. What prompted that?
It was a mixture of things. One, I don't think I ever made a conscious decision at any point in time that I was going to write a book. I was trying to figure out what the greatest use of my time should be once the failure of my first business happened, because, you know, we fought to the final second. And so I think a lot of people saw that we were able to build something pretty substantial, and then we fought to the end. And so then there was a lot of interest for us to, and me specifically, to participate in other ventures and growing other ventures. And so I really needed to dial in where I was going to be spending my time and why. And so I hired a performance coach, and we just started kind of going through the process of, you know, what are your superpowers and what is your definition of success and how do you spend your time? And so as we're going through all of these questions and getting deep on them, not surface level, you know, it's taken me 2 weeks to properly answer one question that he's asking, because, you know, I would give him a surface level answer and he's like, no, that's not it. Keep going. And so I started giving him examples of everything that I had done over the past 15 years. And he said, are these stories true? And I'm like, yeah, yeah, they're all true. And he's like, dude, you need to write a book. And I'm like, I'm not really interested in writing a book. You know, I want to be behind the scenes. I don't want to be in the public, really. And he's like, I spend 99% of my time trying to convince my clients to not write books because they're not interesting and they have nothing to say and they can't help anybody with it. I think you need to write a book. And so initially for the first couple months, I just kept saying no. But as an exercise, every morning, and this is just my normal rhythm, I wake up and I write. And it, you know, I read it in a book years ago. It's called Morning Pages, and it just helps me get all of the chaos out of my brain on paper, and then I can start the day fresh. So instead of doing the Morning Pages routine, I started writing down the story. And some days, nothing came out, or I would get to a really kind of painful point in my journey, and I just literally couldn't do it. I didn't want to start my day off with that level of negative energy. But the next thing I knew, I had 350 pages written down of the chronological story of me building this company. And so once I had that down, I sent it to him and I said, hey, if you're ever curious about all the wild stuff that I've done, here it is. So he read it and he goes, I want you to build out the first four chapters like it's a real book, not just the chronological 30,000 foot story. I go, okay. So I write out the first four chapters like it's a book and I send them to him and he goes, now do another four and another four. And then he said, and this is over the course of like a year, and he goes, you need to see if an editor's interested. And I said, okay. So I started just calling again, never thinking it was actually going to become a book. In my mind, I was thinking, worst case scenario, my kids, I have four of them. Today is actually my second child, oldest son's birthday, 12-12. Happy birthday, Severn. And at a minimum, they will know what I did from the age of 25 until today. And so then I talked to an editor and she's the complete opposite of me. She's magnificent. It's hilarious. And I was referred to her and I said, hey, I did this thing. And she goes, yeah, you know, I only take a couple clients a year. I don't know if I'm interested in this type of story. Send me what you have and I'll call you on Monday. And I said, okay. So I send it to her. And on Monday, she called me and she goes, I thought I was going to read three pages of this and tell you to go pound sand. I'm 65 pages in, and this is one of the wildest stories I've ever read, and I'm in. And I go, okay. So then she and I began to map out the story, and really it was more of an elimination process of details that were not relevant for the overarching book. And so that really kind of led me to, all right, now we have something done. Let's see if publishers are interested, which they were. So then we went through kind of that vetting process. And, you know, I've spent my career creating products, launching products, selling in products to major retailers all across the country. And so once I got the book proposals, I kind of was like, well, you know, explain the details. Like, you get X percent of all the intellectual property forever. Why? Like, what are you going to be doing for me that I can't do myself from a project management perspective or a product launch perspective? And so then I found this really interesting group that is a custom book publishing group that basically does everything a la carte. You just have to obviously pay for everything up front. And I wasn't really interested in this book making money or being tied to sales goals or kind of having someone else's opinion in the process. And so I really liked that group. So I, you know, said no to a couple others and I said yes to them. And then I started going through the actual publishing process, which the level of new brain wrinkles in my frickin' brain every single day has been wild. You know, I don't know how many people really do something new to the point where they know nothing about it at all. And that has been that process for me, which it's been really kind of intellectually stimulating and at the same time, you know, full of adventure. Because, you know, the last time I had this level of adventure, I launched a company and I was 25 years old. So it's been a really kind of wonderful journey.
Sounds exciting. I mean, as it is. Tell me, I mean, did you write pen on paper or were you using a computer to do your drafts?
So initially I was pen on paper. And then what I would do is I would go pen on paper and then I would rewrite it on, you know, I would type it and then I would then save it. And then I started kind of getting to the point where my ideas were faster than my pen could write, or it was legible enough for me to then go back and replicate it. Right. So then I moved to a typing process every morning.
Okay.
Which was interesting because usually I go pen to paper in the morning, but then I just kind of got into a great rhythm of just typing and whatever came out, save, move on.
Wonderful. And at this point, were you reading it out, apart from your coach, were you reading it out to somebody like your wife and saying, hey, this is what I'm writing down, this is what I'm getting down? Did you get any opinion from anybody around you?
No, I didn't even tell them that I was writing a book until really until an editor said, yes, let's move forward with this process.
Ah, okay.
So I was 350 pages in before I was ever like, hey, I'm going to hire this editor. I think I'm going to write a book. I'm going to see what they say about it. And we're going to see how it evolves. Because a book is very similar to a product, right? Like you want to launch something that is the best possible version of your creative process. And then you also want it to be impactful. You don't just want to spend time and money so that you can just sit there and go, wow, I did this thing. Now there was a part of that for sure, but that's, I took this approach of if it turns out to be something magnificent and it's meant to be a book, then it will be a book. And if it's not, then again, worst case scenario, I have the story written down. I can show my kids one day and I'm fine with that as well.
Right. So once your coach was reading through this and basically encouraging you to write the next version, At that stage, did you get somebody in to read it, or even then, no? It's only after the editor was, you had got the green signal from her, that's when you decided that, okay, maybe it's something that I should let others in.
I still did not let anyone read it outside of my performance coach and the editor. Those were the only two people until it was complete that I allowed to read it. And then once that part was done, and then we were in the next level of the editorial process for grammar and structure, then I allowed people to read it. And again, this goes back to, you know, running my salad dressing company. It's most people are not great when you bring them in to the middle of the creative process, right? They only harp on, well, what are you going to do about, you know, the lid of this bottle? And you're like, we're talking about the flavor. I need you to give me feedback on the flavor, not the lid. And so I take that approach now where it's like, I give people the final product.
Yeah.
And then if there's some edits that need to be made, which there were a couple,
sure,
then there's still time to make some changes.
Right. Right. While you were writing and while you were sort of getting to this idea that this may become a book, were you reading some other books of similar kinds, which will sort of give you some input, some ideas? Were you doing any of that?
No. So I'm generally a ferocious reader. I just kind of never stop reading or listening to audiobooks. And it's really interesting that you asked that question, because nonstop, I'll finish a book, boom, next up, do another one.
Yeah.
This took all my capacity, my brain capacity. And so I would attempt to listen to a new audiobook or read a new book, and I just couldn't. My brain would not allow me to distract myself. And I thought that was really interesting, because there are authors that I like and there's books that I love. And, you know, you do kind of think you want to layer some of that stuff in there. But in reality, I couldn't do it. My brain would not allow me to do it.
Yeah. Yeah. Were you also consciously editing out stuff that you thought, I don't want this to be written down, even for my children to read, or anybody to read for that matter? These are like dark places we don't want to go to.
That's funny you say that. The editor did that for me. I wrote everything. Okay. So I was fully prepared for all the stuff to be out there.
Okay.
And she would come and go, hey, we can keep it if you think it really needs to be in there, or we can describe the situation in a way where it implies, you know, for example, what you said about that person. Yeah. And I'm like, okay, I understand what you're telling me. Do not put my quote about this person and my feelings in that moment of rage in there. So initially everything was in there, and then we selected some of the stuff out and kind of changed the structure a little bit about it so that it was implied.
Right. And I think it's a nice segue to actually move into the content of the book. But before that, I have one last question on this part, which is, very interestingly, your chapters are called chapter 1, chapter 2, chapter 3, and chapter 4.
Right.
But you didn't put any descriptive title to those.
Yeah.
Which I found rather interesting.
Yeah.
What was going through your mind when you, I'm sure you thought about it, right? That typically when you read a book, there's a chapter.
Yeah, we talked about it.
Reading fiction, there is a chapter, right? And the chapter title. But I'm not going to do that. I'm going to say 1, 2, 3, 4, 10, 20, 30, whatever.
Yeah, right, right, right.
What was it that was going through your mind?
I think I wanted it to unfold like the actual journey unfolded, which is you didn't know what was coming. You didn't. Yes, this thing ended and it was dramatic. And then, but like, what happens next? And so there wasn't even a precursor to say, you know, the journey or the fight or the this. You're just like, I'm going to turn this page and I don't know what's coming. Okay. And so in that instance, we just didn't, you know, there was a part where I'm like, well, maybe I love quotes. So it's like, maybe each one will have a quote.
Right.
And we just decided, nope, we're just going to keep it numbers.
Hmm. That's very interesting. And I can totally imagine that somebody like you who is reading so much, listening to so much, you have so many quotes that you like, and mm-hmm. I'm sure they can be relatable in terms of, okay, in this chapter, this quote will go really nicely.
Right.
But not, I think I have to give you a lot of credit for avoiding that temptation, because it can be very tempting.
I mean, all you want to do is quotes and descriptors and, you know, well, this could have the perfect quote there. And we didn't do it, which in retrospect, I actually like.
Yes. So let's move to the book itself. You grew a company.
Yep.
From zero to $300 million.
The value was between 300 and 500. Yeah,
exactly.
Yep.
So what was that piece like? Because it's very difficult to do that.
Yeah.
I know, and I've spoken to enough number of people, it seems easy.
Yeah. If you look on YouTube, everybody says you can do it in 4 seconds.
Exactly. Exactly. Right? You just have to buy that course for only $99.
Exactly.
You got $1 million coming, right?
Right.
Yeah. I mean, people fall for it. People. Mm-hmm. I mean, this is the thing about human beings. We want everything easy, right?
Yes.
I mean, if somebody can tell us it's easy,
yeah,
we're in. We are in.
Yeah. We are in. We are in.
Yeah. So tell me, I mean, I'm sure when you started,
mm-hmm.
You are not thinking of building something that big, right? You just wanted to do something which you'll own, which will be yours.
Yeah. I wanted to live a life that was interesting.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I read an example, you know, it's like the rocking chair mm-hmm. test. When you're in your late 80s and you're sitting on your front porch in your rocking chair and your grandchildren are all around you, what kind of life are you going to tell them about?
Mm.
And I thought about that at the time before I started the company. And it was like, you know, not, it's kind of interesting so far, but it's not really that interesting. Mm. And so, and I'm also really good with risk. I can observe how to do things. And then I can process, all right, worst case scenario, this is what happens. Here's what I'll do if, you know, the whole thing implodes and I'm 26 or 27. I mean, it's like, can you really fail at 25, 26, 27 years old? It's like, no, mm-hmm. Some people are still in college at that point.
Right.
So I knew I wanted to build something and I knew I wanted it to be bigger than just a small local business, but I didn't know how large I could grow it.
Mm.
And so I took a very kind of methodical, sport-focused approach. You know, I played lacrosse in college and professionally. And so it's, okay, this is our first goal. Our first goal is to be the number one salad dressing in this one store. Mm. All right, we've done that. Now we're going to be the number one salad dressing in 10 stores. Can we do that? All right, we've done that. Can we do it in 30 and 60 and 90, et cetera, et cetera? Mm. And so each part of that process, there were these little tests that we needed to see if we could pass. Could we go beyond local? Could we go beyond regional? Could we be a national brand? Could we be a national brand for the masses? And so we just kept going and seeing how far we could push it and how we could innovate and how we could scale and what needed to happen to do all of that. And we took it to the point where we could. And it ended in a fiery blaze, honestly. And that process was an unbelievably painful experience. But at the same time, there was so much to learn. And I learned so much about human behavior, and I learned so much about myself, and I learned so much about the world, and I learned so much about perspective. And so all of that was summarized and wrapped up in this book,
right?
Because you don't ever hear about the guy that started something from nothing and grew it to number one in its category and, you know, fought to the death, and then it ended in an epic failure. And then he doesn't write a book about his failures.
It's time for a short break. Stay with us after the break.
And I'm like, what kind of man steals another man's salad dressing? But then I thought to myself, what type of salad dressing is good enough to steal?
Hmm.
And so then I used my only business skill that I had at the time, which was cold calling. And I started cold calling grocery stores. And I just convinced them to take a meeting with me. And they took a meeting with me. And so then I walked in. We didn't have a bottle. We weren't a company. We were nothing. I walked in with a Tupperware container of crunchy romaine lettuce with this dressing on top. And I said, hey, here, you have to try this.
You are listening to a Business Podcast Network original. Podcasting is the fastest growing content marketing opportunity, which is untapped. We can help you craft your audio strategy and help leverage the wide reach and easy streaming capability that the smartphone penetration provides. It is easy, it is powerful and personal. Talk to us to find out how podcasting can help you build your brand and reach out to your targets like never before. Write to us at bpn@bizcast.in. That is bpn@bizcast.in. Business Podcast Network. Podcasts end to end.
Welcome back. I'm Shubhanjan Sarkar, your host for Bits About Books and founder of PitchLink, the buyer-seller engagement platform. Let's dive right back into the episode where we left it.
You know, I know... You have mentioned it as a failure, and we'll come to that. I mean, I have a slightly different perspective, like you say, points of views, right? So I have a different point of view on that, whether what you call a failure. I mean, yes, of course, the business is not there anymore. It's not with you anymore and so on. But before that, I want to sort of ask this question, and I think a lot of people would think about it. You never ran a business before this. You were 25.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
How were you setting these goals? I mean, how did you sort of figure out, you know, the flavor components? I'm sure you did some tweaking. You tasted hundreds of salad dressings that were out there. You were thinking of healthy stuff versus non-healthy stuff. What would be appropriate to be putting in on the dining table? Mm-hmm. What would you do? Will you load it with sugar and so on? I'm sure there are hundreds of these questions going through your mind mm-hmm. when you were actually doing this. How did you actually do it? I'm really curious.
So the idea came because I was selling insurance. And the office was located above a bodega overlooking a graveyard. I'm not kidding. And I'm just sitting there and I'm, you know, I'm doing well because I can work hard and I was willing to cold call all day. But I knew I needed something else. And so every day at my lunch break, I would go home and I would stand on my head in the dark, and I would wait for an epiphany. And then when that never happened, I would walk downstairs and I'd make myself a big salad. And I would use the salad dressing that my mom had made for me. And it olive oil, lemons, garlic, mustard, sea salt. And it was the same dressing she'd made since we were little kids. One day, this dressing in a 2-liter bottle was missing from my house, this little townhouse. I'm looking everywhere. I'm opening cabinets. It doesn't make sense. I call my wife, Genevieve, have you seen the salad dressing? And she's like, Greg, open your eyes. I mean, it has to be there. I'm like, it's not anywhere. And she's like, well, maybe someone stole it. I go, someone stole the salad dressing. Really? She goes, I don't know what to tell you. And she goes, call some people. And, you know, I don't actually care. And so I hang up the phone. I'm like, I am going to call somebody. I'm going to call someone I know doesn't eat salad, you know. So I call this guy and I'm like, hey, man, this is a crazy question, but have you seen my salad dressing? And he's like, yup. Woke up this morning, was jonesing for it, hopped on the scooter, knew the code to your house, came in, took it. Now I'm crushing a salad. And I'm like, what? And I'm like, what kind of man steals another man's salad dressing? But then I thought to myself, what type of salad dressing is good enough to steal? Mm. And so then I used my only business skill that I had at the time, which was cold calling. And I started cold calling grocery stores. And I just convinced them to take a meeting with me. And they took a meeting with me. And so then I walked in. We didn't have a bottle. We weren't a company. We were nothing. I walked in with a Tupperware container of crunchy romaine lettuce with this dressing on top. And I said, hey, here, you have to try this. So the guy takes this piece of wet lettuce out, licks the dressing off, and goes, that's the greatest salad dressing I've ever had. You need to call the regional office. So then I did the same process with them. And as all of that's unfolding, I'm starting to figure out, how am I going to do this? Why is this special? What can I do to scale this? And so then I Googled my way into becoming a food manufacturer. It was not easy. We got in for the grand opening of this store. We ended up setting a national sales record in the first week of the most salad dressing sold in one store in 5 days. And so then with that momentum, I just decided to strategically improvise. Can we get into 2 stores? Can we get into 5 stores? How can I make this dressing at scale? How can I make this dressing at scale without ruining the flavor? And so that just type of mindset of just constantly asking yourself questions and then putting yourself in the customer seat. Why are they buying this? Because it just tastes better than everything else. Okay, got it. So don't mess up taste. And so then that led to us having to start our own manufacturing plants because nobody could co-pack it. Then we ended up inventing clean manufacturing, which no one had ever done before. And so that just process of how do we give our consumer what they want and just not screw it up was how we ended up just, you know, setting goals and saying, just being aware, okay, we're in one store. Let's see if we can get into 10 or 20 or 1,000 or 5,000. And so that was the mentality from day one until the end.
So, and how were you, obviously you're hiring for functions, right? You're hiring sales guys, you're hiring manufacturing guys, you're hiring a head of plants, you're hiring, you're hiring people who will help you set up the machineries and so on. How were you doing that? I mean, how did you know, okay, this guy I can rely on, this guy will not mess up my plant, or this guy will not advise me to buy some fancy machinery, which I don't really need, and so on?
Well, I didn't do that. We, you know, each stage was a completely different hire that we needed to make. Initially, we just needed people that believed in our brand and the pursuit of the American dream. So you needed positive people with a lot of energy that could spread that energy to as many people as possible. Then the next phase was we needed that, but we also needed people that were smart and could start making better decisions while kind of maintaining our core values. And then each step of the way, we had to bring in somebody else. But there's this concept of growing through people. Uh-huh. So you need people to grow. But then also everybody basically has almost a revenue level that they can take you to. Uh-huh. And then that becomes their ceiling. If you want to grow, you have to go through that process and bring on the next echelon of person.
Right.
That is difficult for a lot of people to do. Because when you start your entrepreneurial journey, most people are doing it because they don't want rules. They don't want organizational structures. They don't want to have to fire people. You know, we have a brand, one of the businesses I'm in, we have a brand accelerator. And there's a young guy and we've helped him launch a business and he's growing it. And he had to fire his first person. And he couldn't do it. Mm. And having that level of kind of internal emotional discipline to look at the situation and say, this is what needs to be done to accomplish our goals. And I think that kind of comes back to sports a little bit.
Right.
You can evolve into it. It's not easy. But I think looking at it and making your goals crystal clear and then having metrics for everybody to hit that roll up or down to those goals allows you to see things more clearly. And, you know, you can approach somebody that is a sales guy. Hey, here are your targets. You're not hitting your targets. Can you explain to me why? Sometimes it's the person. Sometimes it's you. And then you adjust. But you keep that culture of accountability, just like a professional sports team or a college sports team. If you're a football player and your job's to catch a football in the end zone and you don't catch the ball anytime it's thrown to you, you don't have a job.
Yeah.
And so I think that part of being on teams was very helpful in scaling the business early on because we had no real business knowledge at all about anything, but we were very competitive. We had a lot of energy. We were very focused. And so that allowed us to scale. And then it allowed me to lead, but the leadership side of that's a completely different animal outside of the culture side.
Yes. Yes, absolutely. And what were the leadership lessons that you learned in that process?
There are a million of them. In the book, at the end of each chapter, there's a field guide of the lessons learned from each phase of the journey. And it's broken down real easy, what you need to know and how to do it. I think if you had to summarize a lot of it, trusting my gut is probably the main thing, that when I did that, things worked out. And when I was convinced that my gut was wrong because I was too young or too inexperienced or whatever, things really didn't work out. Mm. And so just having a deeper understanding of you being the leader, that this brand is a living organism with a vibrational frequency and you're tapped into it and other people from the outside are not. They can still give you advice. You can still use that to really think through your big decision-making processes, but your gut knows what's right and wrong.
Right. Right.
And that was one of the big things.
Did you raise any money at all through this process?
Yes. So we were 3 years ahead of the clean eating movement, you know, the organic clean eating movement. And so initially nobody believed. It's funny to say now. I mean, you look back on it now, you're like, how is that even a thought? people didn't believe organic salad dressing was going to work.
Hmm.
And so you'd have these conversations. They're like, yeah, it's probably just a trend. And we'd be like, great tasting food is a trend? You know, you're like, yeah, it's organic and there's clean ingredients, but it tastes better than everything else. They're like, yeah, we don't know. We don't know if that's going to work. And so you're like, okay. So we did have to raise a lot of money because we were the trailblazers of that movement. Hmm. And so we were raising money from friends and family. We're raising money from high net worth individuals. Then we got into, you know, people's personal home offices. We never got into venture capital or, you know, traditional private equity groups. It was usually high net worth individuals that saw what we were doing, understood what we were saying, and saw our energy and wanted to participate in that process.
And what would be the total amount of money that you raised?
I think over the course of 15 years, it ended up being probably like $30 million, 20, something in the maybe like upper 20s.
Sure. And what was your turnover at the peak, like annual top line?
So we had done right before it ended we ended the year at doing around 70 million in sales. And then going into that first quarter, our run rate was on track for about 100.
Okay. So with that setting, which is like amazing, what went wrong?
Well, it was a mix of things. So COVID was not super helpful. Mm-hmm. We navigated it really well because we owned our own manufacturing plants. So I was very thankful for that. The supply chain crisis was really hard because the world's sunflower oil was produced in Russia and Ukraine. And so then you had basically a shortage of everything. And then gas prices went through the roof. And then there's still truck driver shortages. And now everything's going up in price and retailers are not adjusting the price because they think it's temporary. And you should assume all of the price increases so it doesn't get passed down to the consumer. And then all of that chaos doesn't make investors very easy. So then we started having a lot of investor conflict. And one group wanted to do one thing, and another group wanted to do another thing, and another group wanted to do another thing. And so then you started having a lot of investor distraction conflict. And my focus went to trying to make sure all of that was taken care of. So, you know, they're getting lawyers involved. We're getting lawyers involved. They're getting professional negotiators involved. We're getting professional negotiators involved. And so then it really came down to the only thing everybody could agree to was to sell it. Now, they wanted to sell it in the middle of complete chaos, right? It's just the end of COVID. We're in the supply chain crisis. They wanted to sell the business. So then we hired an investment banking group, and that whole process was botched. And so then when the bids did not come in the way that everybody thought they should, including the investment banking group, and they had valued us at such a high price, people go, all right, well, we're just going to take this thing for ourselves. And so then everybody really lawyered up and, you know, World War III began. And so then for the next, I guess, 2 years, we just battled in court. And at every step, we tried to find kind of a best case scenario for everybody involved, but everybody just wanted everything. You know, we hired a professional negotiator and he thought he was, you know, big stuff. And he comes in, he's like, this, you know, this will be resolved in 30 days. I go, unless you're giving them everything, you're not going to get anywhere. And he looked at me like, boy, won't you take a seat? Let the big dog work. All right. I would love for it to work. We've been dealing with this for years. So, okay. You know, 90 days in, we're paying him an arm and a leg. And he's like, I've got nowhere. There's no point to even have me. And I said, I know. I told you. And so then we had to restructure the business because nobody would play ball. We thought that would be an action causing event where everybody would come together. We'd all, you know, lock arms and sing songs and frolic in the sunlight. And that did not happen. And so that whole process of restructuring was also a battle. And then the next thing you know, this just kind of one once magnificent brand that's lighting the world on fire is being handed over to a PE group for pennies. And you sit there and you just go, wow. Wow. What an end to a magnificent story. And it's not really how it should have ended in my mind, but it happened for a reason. And
yeah,
now I have a book. Now I have a book out of it.
Yeah. I mean, when investors get their ego up above the business, that's exactly what happens. And especially investors who never run a business in their life. Obviously, I mean, the biggest learning during this phase would be about human character, right?
Yep.
And it's not pretty.
No, it's not. It's way worse than you could ever imagine, which I think was pretty surprising.
Yeah.
When you're young, you know, you think the world is all sunshine and rainbows. And you know, then you get into it and you realize, okay, this is aggressive. And I've heard stories about how aggressive it can be. But when you really get into the thick of it, I was shocked at the lengths people are willing to go for destruction.
Exactly, right? Nobody's getting anything out of it.
Right.
But they still want to do that.
Yes. It was just, you know what? Even if I don't get a dollar, I'm gonna kill this dude.
Yeah.
And you sit back and you know, you read about motives and human behavior and you're at a loss.
Yeah.
Because if that's all they want, it's, you know, you can defend it and you can battle as hard as you can.
Yeah.
But at the end, it is mutual destruction.
Yes.
And it's that concept of being dead right. Okay. Yeah, you're right. I don't know what we got for it.
Yeah.
So the ego side is, you're spot on with that.
Yeah. Yeah. I can. And that's what makes me so nervous about when people say that, oh, nuclear war, nobody's going to do that because, you know, they know everybody's going to die. I said, dude, have you ever seen the world?
Right.
I mean, they don't care.
Right. Well, it's a lack of care, and then it's also a lack of understanding of the other consequences that have not been thought out.
Yeah.
Right? Like, oh yeah, we'll just do all of this and this is what they're going to do back.
Yeah.
Well, that's what you think is gonna happen.
Exactly.
Right? You don't know what they're going to do.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, this is so real and so good. I'm so glad that you are saying this and you've written it. So what next for you?
Well, I'm on this book tour, which is really fun. and I'm learning a whole bunch of new stuff, and I'm meeting a whole bunch of cool people. So that is taking up a lot of my time, which I enjoy. We have a bunch of other businesses that we run now and that I run. You know, I'm still in business with my brothers and my wife in different ventures. And so we have a brand accelerator, and then we have a produce business, and we're launching an alcohol business here in the next 30 days. And we have a Port-a-John business through the brand accelerator, which is actually a lot of fun. Interesting business to get in. Again, more brain wrinkles. And then we're investors in some things, and we bought half of a manufacturing business. So there's a lot of application of the learning lessons in the book that I use every day. And I actually find that to be the most interesting part, where you think these learning lessons are universal, but you write them and you go, well, maybe that was just my journey. And, you know, it's a narrow view of the world. But then every business has its issues, and every human has the normal tendencies of human behavior, et cetera. And so I find myself using these learning lessons over and over and over again, which actually is really refreshing, because I know that they're valuable to other people, including myself. And I know how to interact in those situations now, whereas when you first interact with chaos or your potential demise, you don't know how to process that. You don't know what the consequences are going to be. So all of that has been really fun. And so now it's about, you know, scaling businesses still, because I enjoy it. Launching new products, because I enjoy that. I'll probably write, you know, a spinoff to this book, which is, you know, a more in-depth breakdown to the field guide of that book. And then I'm just, again, doing some executive and CEO coaching stuff for young entrepreneurs, which is, again, really fun, because all of the issues they're dealing with, they think are so special to them. Yeah. And you're like, dude, come on. No, here you go.
Right.
This is how you got to be thinking about it.
If you had to go back and tell your 25-year-old, these are the things you should be aware of, beware these things, or even not that, I mean, what advice would you give yourself?
Well, I wrote this book because this is the book I wanted to read at 24 before I started it. Because it's a pressure test. Yeah. Are you prepared to go through this journey? Because this is what can happen. And the example I give is, I'm an advanced scout who's figured out the trail. I've come back. I've given you the map. There's a list of resources that you're going to need. And then you're going to need to make the decision if you want to embark on that journey. And so the awareness side, I mean, the list is so long. Would I change anything? No, I wouldn't. Because I'm the type of person that needs to learn through experience. And I have the ability to pull off a lot of stuff. And I needed to see the full spectrum of business and entrepreneurship and people so that I could have a better grasp on today, myself, what's important, tomorrow, where I want to be spending my time, what matters. And so as I look back, I wish I could have given this book to myself and go, hey, man, I know you're still going to do it, but read this, because it's not going to be easy. It's not going to be as easy as you think. Huh. You're going to get these little moments with massive wins. And then it's going to be a season of pain. And you need to prepare yourself for that emotionally and physically. And so now, from a preparation perspective, how I prepare for the day and the activities I do in the morning and the day, and how I approach the night and sleep and supplements, those are things I wish I could have given myself to. Because a healthy mind cannot live in an unhealthy body. And so often we want to numb our pain or numb our anxiety or numb the chaos of the minute. And in reality, you need to sit into it and you need to figure out how you react to it. And then you need to figure out how you can leverage that to set yourself up for success the next day. So those are just a couple of the little areas I would go back and go, hey, man.
Great.
Bits About Books is brought to you by PitchLink, the buyer-seller engagement platform. PitchLink makes buying easy by enabling high-quality engagement between buyers and sellers through its presentation and discussion modules. Sellers create customized sales narratives using sales collaterals and personal videos, and reach out to prospects through a non-intrusive, buyer-qualified engagement. PitchLink requires no installation or download and holds the entire repository of sales collaterals and buyer-seller conversations. Talk to us to know more about how you can engage with customers without intrusion. Call us on 99021-631-32.
Greg, thank you so much. I think I really enjoyed this conversation. I hope you enjoyed it too. Although you're having similar conversations twice a week, you say.
Well, not on this specific topic. So this has been unique and wonderful.
Thank you. Thank you so much. I really appreciate, and hopefully whenever you are penning the next one, you will give me a heads up and we'll have another chat.
Okay, great.
Thank you.
We have a fantastic lineup over the next couple of episodes with great conversations on breakthrough books. Subscribe in your favorite podcast app so you do not miss a single episode. Thanks for listening.
Thank you for being with us today on Bits About Books, where we talk to authors about breakthrough books on sales, marketing, and business. We hope this conversation helped inform and motivate as we all navigate a rapidly changing business environment. For us, these are enlightening conversations enriched with knowledge and expertise. We encourage you to go out and buy the book to learn firsthand and implement some of the great ideas we discussed today. We hope to have you with us again in the next exciting episode of Bits About Books. If you liked what you heard, subscribe to the show in your favorite podcast platforms like iTunes, Google Play, Spotify, or wherever else you get your podcast from, and give us a rating while you are at it.
This BizCast original podcast is produced for PitchLink, the next generation buyer-seller engagement platform, where the mission is to make buying easy. Hosted by Subhanjan Sarkar and produced by Rajiv Aditya. See you next time and have a wonderful day.